TalkRL.
TalkRL podcast is all reinforcement learning all the time, featuring brilliant guests, both research and applied. Join the conversation on Twitter at TalkRL podcast. I'm your host, Robin Chauhan. Hi, I'm very excited today to be joined by Dr. Ian Osmand. Ian is a research scientist at OpenAI, working on decision-making under uncertainty. Thank you so much for being here, Ian Osmand.
Thanks a lot, Robin. Thanks for having me. I feel like a real celebrity here today. Big fan of the podcast.
Thank you so much. Well, you absolutely are a celebrity, and I've been looking forward to meeting you and talking to you for actually many years. I've been following your work. I think a lot of people listening to the show will know your name. And, you know, I've always thought of you as a thought leader for dealing with uncertainty in RL, and specifically epistemic uncertainty, which is really so central to the challenge of RL, and yet it gets glossed over so often as well. I've been a big fan of your work going back to bootstrapped DQN and your randomized value functions. I remember when OpenAI's randomized network distillation came out. That was back in 2018. I remember when that came out and thinking it was so cool. It was a solution for exploration. But I only recently realized, preparing for this episode, that they were building on your work, and they say that in their paper, which I was excited to see. And I also remember when B-Suite came out and seeing that your agents did so well on exploration tasks, the behavior suite. But I only realized now, preparing for the show, that you were the first author on that paper as well, which I did not realize at the time.
Well, I don't know if that makes it more impressive. That probably makes it less impressive because I could pick what went into it. But yeah, I do like that work. Thanks.
Yeah, you maybe had a little bit of a head start by writing the paper, but and I also remember watching your PhD thesis, which I came to a couple years late in 2016, and we'll link to that as well and these other things in the show notes. But all this to say, I'm super happy to finally get to talk to you, Ian. And in your own words, how do you like to describe your area of focus?
Okay, well, yeah, thanks a lot. And great, you know, really great overview. I think I'm interested in learning agents that learn to make good decisions and take good actions. So that's what I view as like the key thing in reinforcement learning. And I guess for me, you know, reinforcement learning is commonly used kind of confusingly, both as the solution methods and the problem. And I'm definitely much more interested in the solution. In the problem. And the problem, the key elements, I think, for reinforcement learning compared to standard supervised learning is you have to be able to generalize from data sets. That generalization learning, that's the standard supervised learning. But when you take actions, there are two other problems. So one of them people call exploration is that basically you may only learn about actions that you actually take. You don't necessarily get, you know, you don't get law of large numbers, central limit theorem when you don't gather data. So you won't necessarily find out what's good just from observing the data. And then the second thing is delayed consequences or long-term consequences. If I take an action now, it can influence the state of the system in the future. And I think in dealing with both of those extra challenges, I mean, dealing with uncertainty, I think, is important in generalization as well. But I think it's critically important for dealing with exploration and long-term consequences. And so that word you use there, epistemic uncertainty, I think it's a good word for people who know what it means, but it sounds a bit pretentious. I think there's this question. It's like, hey, when there are things I don't know in the world, are there two different ways of knowing what I don't know? So you might say that there's, you know, I've got a fair coin, I flipped it a million times, and half the time it comes up heads and half the time it comes up tails. And so if I flip it, I think it's going to be 50-50. And I think I know it's 50-50, and it's 50-50 due to chance. And some people call that aleatoric uncertainty, because alia is Latin for dice. The idea is it's chance uncertainty. And then there's this other idea of like, okay, you know, someone tells me they've got a, they've got a pet, and it could be a dog or a cat. It's one of the or the other. It could be 50-50, but I don't know which one. And that's sort of uncertainty due to knowledge. There's nothing chance about it. And episteme is like ancient Greek for knowledge. And so people call that epistemic uncertainty, or it's like, I'm going to flip the coin, but it's biased. I don't know which way it's biased. And you kind of need to handle those things differently, depending on the source of uncertainty. And that's, I'd say that dealing with that has been kind of the core of my work in reinforcement learning.
Now, you moved from DeepMind to OpenAI recently, I gather. Did your focus adjust after that move, like maybe more towards LLMs, or can you talk about how your focus is evolving?
Yeah, I think I've always been interested in trying to get these methods, even from PhD. It's like, hey, I want to get these insights from maybe toy or simple settings, but I want to scale them up to the biggest challenges and the largest neural networks and, the leading edge of AI. And definitely that's what I was doing. We were working on that at DeepMind, and I think that's definitely still the focus at OpenAI. Actually, for the past few years, I was working with a team called the Efficient Agent Team at DeepMind, and we were working on these ideas around LLMs. So I think that, broadly speaking, the interest is still the same. Maybe I'm a little bit closer to some of the product work, and we kind of feel like more in the trenches, but both are amazing places, and I'm really happy with the new team at OpenAI.
So we've seen various approaches to dealing with uncertainty and different types of uncertainty in machine learning. And I think when I was coming to the field, I realized there's this giant gap between this kind of world of Bayesian methods, where uncertainty is handled in a very principled and correct way, but they're very costly for even dealing with small problems. And then the deep learning crowd, where people wanna, wish they could do the Bayesian thing, but they can't because it's so costly, and they need to scale up, and then the quality of the uncertainty estimates are not nearly as good. It seemed like almost two different cultures, and there wasn't that much in between, and the efforts to bridge them didn't seem very practical. But I gather you're trying to bridge these two worlds. Is that one way of looking at what you're doing?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. And I think that although some of these things have kind of evolved a little bit separately, I think sometimes that happens because people really focus on specific solution methods. And so you go to the conference and like, hey, we're people who do Bayesian methods, or we're people who do this type of method. And I think that the fields that have made the most progress are where they really focus on the problems rather than the solution method. So like when they did ImageNet, right, a lot of people, if you're really focused on doing well at ImageNet, at some point, hey, I'm an SVM guy or whatever. But when the results came out, everyone's moved on to deep neural networks, and I think they've made a lot more progress because of that. And so I think that the progress in LLMs and AI methods is just astonishing. And yet I think that there's still a lot of untapped potential to make even better machines by kind of taking some of these insights from maybe that are maybe handled more elegantly in the Bayesian literature. And I don't want this to, this can sound a bit pretentious or high level, but I think it's really the core insights are pretty simple. It's like, hey, it's important when you're learning to be able to tell the difference between something you know and something you don't know. And I guess we're going to talk about some of that today, but I'd say surprisingly, even some of our best models, at the moment, aren't built with this from the ground up, or can't do it in a natural way. And I think that if we can improve on that, then maybe we're going to unlock the next, step change in learning algorithms.
Okay, so today we're going to focus on a few of your works in specific and also your themes. But we're going to start with a paper, Reinforcement Learning Bit by Bit. This is from 2021, first author Lu, and with yourself as a co-author. For me, it's been interesting to see this relationship between information theory and RL developing, and you made some really interesting connections here. My background is computer engineering, so we studied some information theory from the like the Claude Shannon perspective and communications and noisy channels. But in RL, I guess the challenge is not just the noisy channel. I guess there can be noise in RL. Maybe rather the idea of like actively steering the agent towards whatever information is more valuable, which is maybe not what Claude Shannon had in mind. So can you talk about that connection a little bit? Is information theory obviously the right framework for tackling exploration in RL? And how do you frame the RL problem in terms of information theory?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. So, I mean, I think this paper, by the way, Reinforcement Learning Bit by Bit, I definitely want to recommend it. I think, you know, I'm not the first author, but I think it's probably one of the best and substantial pieces of work I've been involved in. I think that information theory gives you a really elegant way to think about uncertainty. And actually, when I did my PhD, you know, if people are out there doing, you know, have seen these square root T papers, I did a bunch of them, epsilon, delta, concentration bounds, or whatever. And I think that some of those techniques, they can be good, but they're a little bit inelegant. Whereas sometimes analyses through information theory just feel like they're so much nicer. And allow you to think about things more generally in terms of, you know, generalization and, you know, whereas a lot of the other tools were specifically, you know, they started with, oh, imagine you have a finite number of states, a finite number of actions, and then you go up from there. I think that information theory has really handled generalization in a great way. Now, as you say, the, you know, Claude Shannon kind of genius kind of brought this field almost in one shot. And what I think that RL brings to the table is like, well, we're not actually seeking out information in RL. I think what you're seeking out in the RL problem is this notion of reward, right? And it's up to you to define what the reward is that you want. You know, that just defines the problem. But information is sort of a very important instrumental goal in getting that. Because if you know more about, if you knew everything about the system, then it would just be a planning problem or something like that. And information is really a good way to think about learning. So I think this paper shows a more elegant and kind of coherent way to frame the whole problem and to think about things. Because sometimes if you're not careful, there are little details that don't fully make sense. And I think that if you read through this, I think it's a better way to frame things.
Okay, this paper talks about the idea of information ratio. Can you explain what that is and what does it measure?
Okay. Well, yeah, before we get to the information ratio, I guess there's a few ideas in this paper. I think one of the big ideas is to realize that whenever we're thinking about the world or the agents interacting with the environment, there are kind of there's two key notions. There's one is this idea, which we call an environment proxy. And so that's something like a model of the environment, but it doesn't need to be an explicit model like, oh, given a state, given an action, get a new state. So in the case of something at DQN, it could just be the Q function and the replay buffer or the neural networks that you learn. But kind of formalizing that, hey, there's a separation, or it could be a finite state MDP, right? An agent, you can be interacting in the world and model, you know, warehouse levels and inventory with like discrete states. But that doesn't mean it's the real environment, right? So the real environment is the real world. And then you have this proxy that's your proxy for the real world. And so you know, I think a lot of the framings, you know, in Sutton's book or something like that, they don't really make that distinction clear. They sort of act like the model you have is the real MDP, or it's sort of not clear. That's one notion, the environment proxy. And then another idea is a learning target. So it's like what the agent is going to try to learn about. Now, again, these are kind of complicated things, but it's pointing out more explicitly like, hey, when I'm learning, I don't want to learn about everything. You may want to learn about the optimal policy, right? Because when you talk about information gain, you need to say, what are you gaining information about? And that's the learning target. So you might say, hey, I want to learn the optimal policy. Or you might say, hey, I want to learn the optimal Q values. So this paper is like, it's unusual because it's more of like a big picture kind of framework that a lot of sub algorithms could fall out of. But I think that thinking in this more general way helps to like organize your thinking in a more clear way. And so then the information ratio is this term that comes out both in our analysis of certain algorithms and as something that you can optimize. And it's a ratio between how much you think you're going to learn by taking an action, and how much worse it is than what you think the best possible action is. And so it's quite a natural term. It's something like exploration, you know, versus exploitation. So exploration being trying out things to learn and exploitation trying to do well, given what you know. And this information ratio is this term that comes out as sort of fundamental to these analyses and also suggested for a new algorithm, which or family of algorithms, which we call information-directed sampling.
Okay, and can you talk about information-directed sampling? What is it trying to do, and maybe how does it differ from other major formulations of curiosity that we've seen?
So I think, okay, this at a super high level, this idea of trading off exploration versus exploitation is captured by a lot of different algorithms. And in some sense, the solution is trivial. You can write down your Bayesian, you know, beliefs, and you just maximize your expected return. And that is the optimal, the Bayes optimal solution. The problem is that doing that is essentially impossible computationally, even for very simple problems.
Is that like a belief MDP?
Exactly. You could have this belief, say MDP, and you just solve the MDP. Yeah. But it's got an infinite set of states, and it's, you know, it's impossible. And certainly when you think about like the real world or trying to make a chatbot or something like that, it doesn't really make any sense to think about doing it. But you can write it down on a whiteboard, but it's not something you can actually do.
Mm-hmm.
Now, on the flip side, the other thing is like, hey, I'm going to do the greedy solution, or what some people call estimate then optimize. It's like, hey, I don't know what the world is like. The world's too complicated, but I'll just come up with an estimate for, you know, the Q values or something like that, a point estimate. And I'll say, hey, this is how good different policy is. And then I'll take the one that I think is best. And so that's called being greedy. And then people know that if you're just greedy, you got to try out other things sometimes. So they add in a few random actions. And they're kind of random in a, you know, undirected way. We call that dithering. And so like epsilon greedy, Boltzmann exploration, all of these things are like that. Even if they sound kind of fancy, or they might be sort of good heuristics in some cases, they can be like really, really bad. So take like exponentially long to learn in general. Okay. So I think that, but at least you can run, you know, it's more computationally tractable. So the game is kind of about trading off this statistical versus computational complexity. And something that I've worked on a lot, people might have heard of, is these Thompson sampling, which is this idea that, oh, I don't know what I'm going to do, so I'll randomly choose things according to the probability I think they're the thing to do. That's Thompson sampling. Or some of these curiosity or optimism approaches, which are like, hey, I don't know how good things are, but I'll assume that they're as good as they could plausibly be. And if I assume that it's good, then I'll at least try it. And if it's good, then great. And if it's bad, at least I find out. And so those are a little bit better, or can be good in some scenarios. But they miss out on some of the juice, because they're like a very heuristic way of, their proxy is, if I try things that I think are good, then I'll learn a lot. But there are some things in the world that don't work like that, right? So for example, imagine if I come into I'm late for my interview and I'm in a new floor. I've never been there before. And I know that I've got to be in one of the rooms on the floor, but there are 100 rooms. What would the Thompson sampling approach do? Like, I don't know anything else. I think that you could reasonably argue, say, hey, I'm equally likely to be in any of them, so I'll just pick one at random and go into it. Right? And, oh, no, it's not that one. Okay, go again. Try another one, right? And I just do that through. Eventually, I'll find it. Okay, great. I will find it, but it'll take me about as many rooms, right? But the what you'd like to do is you come on, hey, I don't know where I am. Let me look on the map, right? Now, looking on the map is never the optimal solution. It takes a bit of time. I know that the meeting is not at the map. Right? I know that for sure. But you'd like an algorithm that say, hey, I really don't know what's going on. Let me get the information I need to make the right decision. And that kind of thing, information-directed sampling can do. And it's also a tractable algorithm. So that should be the idea.
So is IDS a form of intrinsic motivation?
Some of these things, like curiosity or intrinsic motivation, it's hard to say exactly what they mean. I think that yes, in a very high level sense, it could motivate you to do things, but it's actually very motivated by what you want to learn about. So IDS is giving you this way to balance what you want to learn about versus how much it's going to cost you. And it kind of looks at those two terms and makes decisions based on that. And whereas some intrinsic motivation approaches they really struggle on how to do this balancing. And I think that's where the interesting thing comes from this approach, and that it's tractable. So if you look in that paper, we've got examples of actually running a version of this with deep neural networks, with, open source code. You can have a go with it. And, it's still proof of concept at the moment, but it shows it's something you can actually do.
On a high level, how do you think about what you can learn in the very next step? Like, I guess Thompson sampling works very well in the bandit setting, where there's just only a one-step environment, or really, there's no steps involved. Whereas in RL, there might be something that you don't know that is a few steps down the corridor. So how do you think about the difference between what you're going to learn in the next step versus what you may learn at some point in the future, even if the next step is familiar? Like, how do you think about time in that sense?
Yeah, actually, you've given me a bit of a layup here, but thanks for that. So the title of my PhD dissertation was Deep Exploration via Randomized Value Functions. And this distinction you're making about what you can learn right now, you take one action and you learn something from that, versus sometimes you have to take a sequence of actions and you won't learn anything until the end. And we call that deep exploration. It's obviously a bit evocative of deep learning, and it's a good word because once you want to be deep, nobody wants to be shallow. But yeah, it's deep because it is over multiple time steps. And just to give an example of that, it's like, okay, imagine, well, in I hate to use the video game analogy, but because I think that people kind of get confused and think RL's only about video games, but in Montezuma's Revenge, this is a sort of famous example. You may need to go, you may need to take hundreds of actions, one by one by one, in order to get to a new room. And probably for the first 10 of those actions, you're not actually learning anything new because you haven't, gone into any, you're just exploring what you already know. You're doing it because you're going to set yourself up to learn something in the future. And that's what deep exploration is about. And I think it's a really important, it's an important aspect of the reinforcement learning problem, and something that makes this exploration problem like even worse for RL. Like it means, I guess that's why I'm interested in working on these exploration or uncertainty things, because when you get this right, you can make the solutions, thousands of times faster or millions of times faster. You can solve problems that you can even prove that even mu zero. And it's not just proving, it's also if you run it, they can't do it. You can solve these problems millions of times faster, even for the best agents, mu zero. And so that's like super exciting to me. This is potentially something that doesn't give you a 5% boost, doesn't necessarily give you a 10% boost. It can be an absolute deal breaker. And so that's why I think it's an exciting thing to research.
Okay, so let's move on to the idea of joint predictive distributions from one of your papers. This is from Predictions to Decisions: The Importance of Joint Predictive Distributions by Wen et al. With yourself as a co-author. Now, this phrase "joint predictions" comes up often in your work, and the first time I came across this idea of yours, I think I wasn't sure how to interpret the joint here, like, what is being joined over? And I gather that it's over something you're calling an epistemic index. Is that right?
Yeah.
What do you mean by joint predictions? And can you give us the gist?
This has been a confusing thing. And so definitely we didn't go into this thing, oh, I'm super interested in joint predictions, right? Absolutely not. So that was more actually only after kind of years of thinking did this emerge as a key concept. So okay, here's the thing. Most machine learning is single input, single output. Like you get one image, you give me one label. You get one image, you give me one label. Okay? And so that's the thing that we're calling marginal prediction. Marginal because it's like there's one. I'm going to get one image, I'm going to make one prediction. Joint prediction is I'm going to get multiple images and I'm going to make multiple predictions. Okay? So I'm going to, instead of one image, I'm going to get 10 images. And you're going to have to give me 10 labels at the same time. And it's not obvious that that has anything to do with decision making, and that's why I guess we wrote these papers. But at least, does that problem? I can give you an example of this, but is that making sense for what joint prediction means?
When you say there's multiple predictions given, like there's some assumption about the independence of those different predictions or the
Exactly.
information that
No,
each of
so
those.
that's the point. So that's the point. That's entirely the point. So we're conditioned, so much work is like, I get one image, I get make one prediction. But the importance of joint prediction is how independent or not independent the predictions are, right? And so one de the definition of what's, I think that this is what information theory, makes so elegant. They've got this thing, this notion of mutual information, and that's the KL divergence between the joint distribution over these multiple things and the product of marginals. So the mutual distribution, the mutual information of X and Y is how different the joint distribution of X and Y is from what it would be if X and Y were independent. So if they're that if imagine if X tells you everything about Y, then they have high mutual information.
Like there's something independent of something that's making them independent, right? Either they're judging in a different way or they have access to different data. Like why do we have multiple judges on a court, on a Supreme Court?
So it's still only one. It's not that. So the idea is there's still only one judge, right? So you're the judge. But imagine I come to you with an image. I come to you with one image, and it's an image of like this small blue alien. And I say, hey, do you think this is a bleep or a blarb? Right? So you're a bleep or blarb classifier. And you'll say, oh, I don't really know, 50-50, right? You don't know anything. Great. But now I'm going to come to you. I'm going to say, okay, cool, 50-50. Great. Now I'm going to come to you with 10 images, and five of them are these blue, small, round things, aliens, and five of them are these yellow, spiky, bigger things. Okay. And I'm going to ask you a different question. I'm going to say, hey, give labels. What are the possible labels for all 10 of these? Which of these are bleeps and which of these are blarbs? Okay, so when you're only classifying one, 50-50, right? But you could make a prediction for all 10. You could say, hey, each one's 50-50. 50-50, 50-50, 50-50, 50-50. Great. But I think if you noticed that there were obviously like two types, you might make a prediction that's like, hey, either all these five are bleeps and the other ones are blarbs, or it's the other way around, right? That's a very different prediction. Right. In one case, if it really works like that, in one case, you've got a 50-50 chance of getting all 10 right. In the other case, you've got a 1 in 1,000 chance of getting all 10 right. So does that make sense? What the joint prediction means? One is, this is back to this epistemic aleatoric thing we said at the beginning. So I've got one coin that I've flipped loads of times, and it's heads or tails. A million heads, a million tails came up. I know it's 50-50, right? And I've got coin B. Now, coin B is like really weird. I bring it out of a bag. I've got a funny grin on my face. And I say, hey, you want to flip this coin instead? And basically, what I'm trying to suggest is that this is a biased coin. If you flip it, it'll always be tails or always be heads, but you don't know which way around it is. Okay? Now, if I ask you coin A or coin B, I'm going to flip them once. Well, what's your probability of heads? It's 50-50, right?
Makes
See,
sense.
so it so if you have a classifier, a neural network that takes in coin and outputs probability of heads, you can't tell the difference, right? Cool. But now you and I are going to play a game. And the game is we're going to have 100 rounds, and each round you get to pick a coin, A or B, you get to flip it. If it's heads, you get $1. If it's tails, you lose $1. Okay? Or we can call it zero. But let's say you win one or you lose one. Now I say, hey, well, what do you want to do? What's your choice? And I'm going to ask you right now, like, what would you want to do?
I would have to
It's too
think about
hard.
it
I'm
a
grilling
bit
you.
more.
Yeah, it's hard. It's hard. Okay. Well, I guess what I'm saying is, okay, if we say you're going to gain one or lose one, if you pick coin A, its expected value is zero, right? So you're not ex it's not really good, it's not really bad, whatever. 50-50. Now coin B, if you flip it, on one flip, it's also either going to be heads or tail, 50-50, right?
You're
So
either
it's
going to
not
win
very
every
good.
time or lose every time on the one coin, right? And the other coin is
Exactly,
going to even out.
exactly. But importantly, you don't need to if you flip coin B, if you flip coin A, you don't learn anything, right? You don't learn anything from flipping coin A. But if you flip coin B and you get heads on the first time, hey, you're in the money. You're going to make $100, right? Great. If you flip coin B and you lose $1, you're not going to flip coin B again, right? You're going to go back to A. Do you see what I mean? Because you can just flip A the rest of the 99. So the best decision is to first you flip coin B if it gives you money. Now I go to I keep doing that. If it's bad, I go to A. So it's clear that strategy is a much higher expected reward, right? Now, a neural network that only can tell you the probability of heads, you can't do that strategy because you can't tell the difference between A and B. Because they had just over one flip, over one marginal prediction, it's just 50-50.
Makes sense.
But I can
Okay.
ask you a different question. If
Yep.
I said, hey, what are the possible distributions over two flips or 100 flips? But let's say two flips. For the one case, for case A, you say, hey, it's equally likely, to be heads, heads, head, tails. If the first one's heads, the next one could be 50-50. If I do the other coin, you say, hey, well, the first one could be anything, but conditioned on the first B1 being heads, I know the second one is heads. And so then you can tell them apart, right? That's another one like saying the information you gain, you can compute this. I want to learn about which arm is the best arm, A or B. If I pick B, I'm going to gain a lot of information about arm B. And that's why information-directed sampling would sample that. So it's like what joint prediction means. Joint prediction is asking, hey, what would happen if I have two flips rather than just one?
So yeah, I haven't heard joint predictions from other researchers very often. Can you help us understand how these ideas relate to other uncertainty approaches that we've seen?
Yeah, so it's a bit of a weird, as I said, it's not something we came into saying, hey, I need to care about joint prediction. But hopefully that coin example with A or B, like that's about as simple, like people will talk about it more as epistemic versus aleatoric uncertainty. So that coin, if we remember, A was the one, it's 50-50, and you know it's 50-50, and B is the one, it could be heads or it could be tails always, but you don't know which one. So people would classically refer to that as epistemic versus aleatoric uncertainty. Coin A is aleatoric and coin B is epistemic, right? And so you want to seek out the things with epistemic uncertainty, and you maybe don't want the things with aleatoric uncertainty. The problem is, I think that's a great way to think about it if you can agree on a model. So if we can agree that this coin is a Bernoulli random variable with probability P, then conditioned on that model, I can say, hey, A has no epistemic uncertainty because P is known and it's 0.5, and B has a lot of epistemic uncertainty because I don't know P. But different people can have different models of the world. For example, you could say, hey, there's no such thing as aleatoric uncertainty in the world. There's only epistemic uncertainty. And if I could just measure every single atom and all the forces when you flip it, then I'd know exactly what would happen when you flip coin A. So coin A is not aleatoric at all. It's just epistemic, and I don't know the answer, right? And certainly, as we start thinking about building more and more complex AIs, I don't think we want to think about building in, oh, this much is epistemic, this much is aleatoric. It doesn't really make sense. There's not really the clear line that you think there is, because it depends on your choice of model. Even for a linear regression, if you and I are using different features, we can disagree on what's epistemic versus what's aleatoric. And so I think that because of that, a lot of, the Bayesian deep learning workshop in NeurIPS, they say, hey, we've got a model and we've trained a ResNet, a Bayesian ResNet. We used loads and loads of TPUs, and we used a certain Monte Carlo scheme, and this is the true posterior, and that's the epistemic uncertainty. And so I'm going to rank you on how well you approximate this method's epistemic uncertainty. So conditioned on a certain model class, how well do you do? But the only thing that's real is the data, right? And it's kind of perverse to say, oh, it's this specific ConvNet and these specific parameters, why this weight versus that? The only thing that's real is the coin. Did you flip it? How many heads came up? And joint prediction is something you can measure on actual data. And so I think that this just, it's not an obvious thing to come, oh, I should measure this joint prediction. But one of the good things is that if you want to minimize this joint prediction loss, so you can measure that just with the usual log loss, except now you're doing it on the joint predictions, the optimal solution is the Bayesian solution, right? So that is the gold standard. So they agree on what's the best possible thing. But one of the nice things about measuring this is you don't need to, inverted commas, be Bayesian. You just need to make good predictions. Although I'll question, what does it even mean to be Bayesian? It might mean making good predictions. So I know I kind of, the hairs on my neck go up a little bit when people just talk, oh, is this Bayesian? Is that Bayesian? I don't really know. But it's clear, I think that this offers a coherent way to think about these things, like what's epistemic and what's aleatoric, which the more we went into it thinking about that, but the more we pushed on it, I think Rich Sutton, Dave Silver were really good about pushing us back on this. They were like, no, that's not a real thing. It's not a real thing. You know, the only thing that's real is the data. And so I think they're mostly right. And they were much more right than I gave them credit at the beginning. But this notion of joint prediction, I think, is novel and important.
There's some kind of beta distribution there. And when you have a joint prediction, then there could be multiple beta distributions. Is that right or no?
Okay, so I guess if you're going to model this in the Bayesian sense, the conjugate prior is you say, hey, I don't know the probability P, and that's following some beta. And so if I want to make a joint prediction, well, I know that it's going to be the same P for all of the realizations. So first I sample a P, and then I sample 100 flips. And I can do this multiple times. And that could be my empirical distribution, and that gives me my joint estimate distribution, right? But I guess what we're saying is that's one way to make a joint prediction that isn't the product of marginals, right? So for example, okay, if I'm Bayesian agent, a perfectly Bayesian agent, I say I want to get a few samples from my posterior. I say, well, P is either 1 or 0 for B. I'm gonna sample that it's 1. If P is 1, then they're all heads. Okay, do it again. P is 1, they're all heads. P is 0, they're all tails. Cool. For the coin A, I know P is a half. So I sample P as a half and I say, oh, 50, 50, 50, 50, right? And that shows a way that you can make joint predictions. But in terms of like the interface, we're not assuming that you have a beta distribution, right? Or something like that. That seems kind of backwards. What if you have, you know, people only picked beta because the exponentials worked out nicely in the update, right? What if you have this other weird intractable heuristic thing or whatever, and the world's way more complicated and happens to be windy on this day and there's a magnet, you know, who knows, right? And the neural network might learn all these things. So rather, we're just going to look at, okay, I'm just going to look at your predictions and I'm not going to care how you made them, right? Obviously, later on, and we're going to talk about that. That's our work on epistemic neural networks. This is about saying, hey, can I make neural networks that make really good joint predictions in this sense of like getting the things that I want out of a Bayesian neural network? But I'm not going to force them to do it the Bayesian way. And I think that's a more productive way to do it.
Your epistemic neural networks paper from 2021. Can you tell us about that paper and what is an epistemic neural network?
Yeah, got it. So yeah, it's this whole area is confusing, and I think the main thing that's confusing is this idea of joint prediction. But hopefully, if we go through those examples, then that's kind of making sense. Like you want to be able to tell the difference between something that you know is 50-50 versus something that you think has a 50% chance of being way better or 50% chance of being way worse. And that problem is like very relevant for large language models, right? Because a classic thing is these reward models that want to tell, hey, is this response better or is that response better? We want to be able to tell the difference between these two cases. Those are like mapping to these two coins, A and B. Something where you know they're like basically 50-50, and something where you think there's a 50% chance it's way better or a 50% chance it's way worse. And the classic way, as we said, that people have been taking this on is they said, hey, well, you've got a neural network that makes predictions. But actually, it doesn't tell you your epistemic uncertainty. So instead of having a normal neural network where you have weights and make predictions, you've got to have a Bayesian neural network. And so instead of one set of weights, you're going to have a distribution over plausible weights. And that's like your posterior. And for any one of these set of weights or possible, you make different predictions. And for the different plausible weights, I'll get these different outputs, and that's how I'll tell how uncertain I am. But that assumes a particular form where basically I'm going to have uncertain epistemic uncertainty over these weights, and then this aleatoric in the outputs. But what we just said before was the only thing that you really needed to do to make good decisions is this good joint predictions. So I need to make good joint predictions over the coin if it's going to be all heads or all tails. But it's not super important that I have a good distribution over a beta parameter p. And it's not super important for many cases that this is even a beta parameter. Certainly not for big neural networks like a ResNet, where you don't really know what's going on. And maybe you don't care that much as long as you make good predictions. So an epistemic neural network is a very broad, it's like an interface for allowing neural networks to make these kind of predictions. And just to stress again, you say, oh, well, don't neural networks already make these predictions? Well, think like ImageNet, ResNet. You give it an image. Is this a rabbit or is it a duck? You just get a probability, a marginal prediction, and you say 50-50. It doesn't tell you which type of 50-50 that is. If you want to know what type of 50-50 that is, you need to make joint predictions. And that's what an epistemic neural network allows you to do. Now, any neural network is sort of by definition, you make it a epistemic neural network by making independent predictions. But clearly those are not necessarily good, right? And a Bayesian neural network is an epistemic neural network because you can do this thing that we said before. You sample the weights, then you make a prediction. You sample the weights, you make a prediction. But it's not essential that you follow that two-step process for an epistemic neural network. We're kind of treating it, at a high level. It's more of a black box. And you say, hey, it's a neural network, and I need to be able to make joint predictions.
I remember from a few years ago at NeurIPS, Dustin Tran at Google trained this giant transformer, a Bayesian giant transformer, and took a huge amount of TPU. And I was both like very impressed and actually kind of horrified by the amount of like resources. And I'm not really sure what came out of it, like how much better things were with the uncertainty. But I was just thinking, man, if this is how things are going, where are we going to get all this compute? And so, but I understand your approach here is a lot more compute efficient, and you have this EpiNets component, which sounds like very efficient. So is it true that you can kind of augment an existing large neural network with your EpiNet, and it doesn't really cost that much to get this type of uncertainty?
Okay, so great. As you say, some of these Bayesian approaches, they're just burning the whole rainforest and they don't really work that well. I think you kind of have to look around, right? And you have to look at how much progress has been happening in deep learning. And it's amazing. There's so much. ChatGPT, all the video models, Gemini, it's incredible. You wouldn't have thought this was possible. And pretty much none of it is happening with the so-called Bayesian neural networks, right? Fair play so far. Not much of it's happening with epistemic neural networks either. But let's look around, and that's not happening. And I think one of the reasons is because one of the key things we're seeing are these scaling laws. Basically, bigger networks, more compute, more data are better. Okay, and the maybe some of these Bayesian approaches, are a little bit better on certain metrics. But they don't match the scaling laws, right? So they're way too expensive. And one of the approaches people do instead is they say, oh, training an ensemble is a bit like being Bayesian or a bootstrapped ensemble. And actually, thinking my PhD was probably one of the first of that in the modern in the DeepRL setting. So I'm not against it. It's kind of a nice idea. It's like, hey, I don't know how to make an uncertainty estimate, so I'll just train a bunch of different neural networks. And if they disagree a lot, then I'm uncertain. It's a cool idea. It's sort of elegant.
I've done it. It's expensive. My God.
It's
It
expensive.
works, but yeah.
It works. It kind of works, but you got to train 100 networks. Who's going to train 100 networks? You might train 10. And even then, well, why don't you just make the network 10 times bigger, right? GPT, I can reveal, GPT-4 is not made by making 1,000 GPT-3s, right? You have a bigger network. Bigger is better. And so I think that that's one of the problems with these approaches. So when we set out, we said, okay, look, those other approaches kind of said the Bayesian. It's like, first, I'm going to have uncertainty over my weights, and then I'm going to get uncertainty over my outputs. So if you think like that, then you basically need at minimum twice the set of weights, a mean and a variance for each one, right? But that's even if it's independent. And like these things are obviously, you know, the neurons are incredibly interrelated. That's kind of the whole point. So these ensembles, you know, if you have 100, it takes 100 times as long. So we said, hey, can we get an approach? We want to get an approach that is only costs slightly more than the single network, but gets performance better than an ensemble size 100. And that was like the idea, the kind of moonshot. And I'm happy to say that, you know, according to this metric of joint prediction, we smashed that with this approach called an EpiNet. And the EpiNet, the way it works is you can take a pre-trained large model and you can add on a few extra layers on the side. It's a really small compared to the original network. And because of some like kind of clever approach that we've got, some of it's a bit hacky, some of it has, we prove that, oh, if you do this in the linear case, it's like recovers the Bayes optimal solution. That if you do this, we get way better performance than even on an ensemble, a full ensemble of size 100, but at a cost only slightly more than a single network. So we're really excited about that.
That is an incredible result.
Yeah.
How does it do that?
Okay, so I think to get into the feel of it, you got to think, okay, well, what's weird about the ensemble approach? And, you know, I'm not picking on that because I view myself as like a proponent of it, but okay. Well, one thing that's weird is if I'm training 100 particles, and like you should think about each particle, you know, maybe think about it as GPT-4. It costs a lot of money. It costs a lot of TPUs. And I'm coming like, hey, guys, it's fine. We're just going to train 100 GPT-4s. Okay, that it doesn't sound right. But imagine I've trained 99. I've spent a lot of money training those 99. Now when I come to particle 100, I don't reuse anything that I learned, right? It seems weird. Like each one of these models learned all these important features and sentiment extraction and all these kind of magical things happened in training that many smart people, you know, understanding pieces, but many other pieces we don't understand. And now you say, okay, just do it again. It seems wasteful, right? So instead of doing that, and maybe one of the challenges of Bayesian deep learning is how complicated neural networks are. We don't fully understand what's going on. Obviously, it's great. People try to understand. But then you say, okay, now this thing I don't really understand, now I'm going to try to do Bayesian inference over this magical black box. Bayesian inference was hard to begin with, even when it was a single variable, right? So that doesn't seem like a great strategy when you've got, you know, billions and billions of weights. So instead of that, I think you can look at, rather than thinking like some of these Bayesian deep learning, say, hey, the model is a neural network, and we're going to be Bayesian about the model. Maybe another way to think about it is saying, hey, I want to be Bayesian about, maybe what you're really trying to do is, I want to be Bayesian about this image classification, or I want to be Bayesian about like, yeah, what words to say, right? And if I was going to set up some really complicated, you know, equations and prior and Monte Carlo, I could work out the Bayes optimal solution, and that would be great. And then I'd have a really good answer. But I don't do that because that's not tractable. So instead, what I do is I train this really, really big neural network. I train it to predict the next token. I train it to whatever, classify images. And so one way you could look about that is you could say, hey, well, I really want to be Bayesian, but someone handed me this magical black box that does approximate Bayesian computation. And the reason I say it's approximate Bayesian is because it's getting the lowest log loss. It's getting the lowest log loss on the next token, right? And obviously the Bayes optimal is the optimal, but this is as close as we can get to it with whatever GPT-4. So rather than saying, okay, I want to be Bayesian about this magical machine, say, hey, wait, this machine is really good at that. Can I alter it in a slightly different way so that I can get something like joint predictions instead of just a marginal prediction, right? And that's what the EpiNet idea is. And the idea is that we're going to perform some kind of randomization. You mentioned this random network distillation. You know, it's a great paper from OpenAI. Some similar ideas we had that kind of, I think, motivated that with this idea of these randomized prior functions, but the exact mechanisms are less important than the idea is to say like, okay, well, I've got this function that's in this certain high dimensional space. But I'm not exactly sure about what the function is. So maybe there are like slightly different versions of the function that would also be plausible. And this EpiNet, by adding this on, you're kind of altering your predictions, but you alter it in this consistent way that leads to good joint predictions. And that's the idea. And the idea is that, okay, well, imagine if the last layer of GPT-4 extracts some feature that says, oh, how the sentiment, right? Well, it'd be very hard to, you train an ensemble, and maybe the different ensemble particles would judge the sentiment slightly differently. But instead of doing that, we could just add on these small, NLPs to some hidden activations. And if you do it carefully, you might say, hey, I'm not exactly sure about how the sentiment is being calculated. And that's the kind of thing an EpiNet, we hope, it is able to do. This is hand wavy, though. I don't put that in the paper because it's not proven or whatever, but that's the idea. What is in the paper is that was the idea. We've got open source code. It's an easy thing to do, and we get way better joint predictions than even a size 100 ensemble.
In your Stanford RL Forum talk, which we'll link to, at one point you said you're not sure why ENNs work. I think if that roughly paraphrasing your quote. Can you say more about that? Like, what is is it just the fact that, I mean, this is an empirical science, I guess, right? AI and machine learning. So is it
Yeah.
more about running more experiments?
So this is I think a confusing thing about the paper is that the paper is called epistemic neural networks. And so basically anything can be an ENN. It doesn't mean it's good, it doesn't mean it works, it doesn't mean it doesn't work. And then we've got this specific ENN architecture, which is called an EpiNet, and we say, oh, that works well. And I guess I was at a Stanford, talk, and I say, oh, we don't really know why it works. There's different levels of knowing, but yeah, I don't know. I kind of just gave my best intuitions for why I search in that area, but no, I definitely don't know.
I mean, people say they don't know why neural networks work at all. So that's, I
Exactly,
think
exactly. There's
we're in great company.
exactly. So I think you just, but I think maybe when you zoom out, okay, put it this way, a lesson from deep learning and all these things has been like make things more end to end, right? And there's been But first, people were doing, oh, you first got to get good features, and then you got to do this, and then you're going to predict the image, and then you're going to autoencode, and then. But so much of the deep learning success has been like, no, get more compute, get more data, train end to end. I think GPT is like the culmination of this next token prediction, and just how much has come out of that. They don't have, oh, have an auxiliary, sentiment loss of this. It's like end to end, go for the thing you want. Now, obviously, next token prediction isn't exactly what you want, but it's pretty cool. So I think that with kind of us realizing the importance of this joint prediction in decision making, we said, hey, let's make something that's just really good at doing joint prediction. And so we really targeted that. And that's what this ENN and EpiNet work does. Whereas other approaches like Bayesian deep learning, maybe they've got these other things that they're aiming for. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. I'm going to have uncertainty over the weights. EpiNet does not give you good uncertainty over the weights. There's no such thing as that. It's terrible, right? Does not even, that's not a thing that it gives. But by focusing on this joint prediction, we're much, much better at that. And so maybe that's where I think the key observation is. And I guess we'll go on to show, I guess, okay, I also view this as very preliminary work because no one actually really cares about joint prediction. Just zooming out again, the thing I want to do is to be able to make good decisions in the real world, right? I want to be able to come to that question I had, hey, coin A or coin B, and pick the right one and get really good performance. I want to make a, chat GPT that gets labels from humans on the right things, that tries out the right things with users and learns to be way better, way quicker. And so ultimately, that's going to be the proof of the pudding. And I think some of that is coming out. I've been involved in some papers. Some of my other co-authors have done more hard at work, trying to get it for the next iterations here. But so I just do want to clarify this. I'd view this joint prediction as like a kind of intermediate goal. It's a good sanity check. And but the proof of the pudding is going to be, when you release something like Sora or ChatGPT, it's like, wow, this is so much better than what people had before. And I don't think that we've done that yet.
So I see you use EpiNets, I guess, to do something like Thompson sampling in RL.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay. So I gather that like doing fully Bayesian Thompson sampling in RL is unobtainable, but it's like the best thing to do with bandits, but we just can't do it with RL. We wish we could. But here you're able to kind of approximate Thompson sampling in RL, is that right?
Yeah, exactly. So,
What does that mean, by the way, to do Thompson sampling in RL?
exactly. So I think rather, and maybe this is linking back to a piece of work that you said before, which was B suite, this idea of behavior suite for reinforcement learning. What does it mean to do Thompson? What does it mean to do good exploration? Well, one of the ideas behind that work was that we would curate little like toy experiments, admittedly toy, but that are somehow evocative of like the key issues. Right. So, for example, if you wanted to test, is the can the agent remember things over multiple time steps, then you would set up this like very synthetic task of like, oh, observe a digit, wait one step, can you remember it? Observe a di digit, wait 10 steps, can you reserve it? And you can just empirically look at the scaling of memory or something like that by this definition, and then you can p compare agents like for like. And so one of that there are a bunch of different attributes, and the idea was that it's an open source thing, different people can contribute. But one of the tasks which we were using to test if you could do deep exploration, this idea of temporally extended exploration, we called it deep sea. We were kind of imagine that you're a diver and you're diving down kind of like this Tetris environment. Basically, it's a needle in a haystack problem. It's set up so that there's a grid size of n by n. And there's basically only one policy. There is one policy that will get you the optimal reward of one. So it's just set up to be the like kind of the maximally like perverse but hard. But it's not meant to be a real problem. It's meant to be symbolic of something else. And for size n, it has a natural scaling factor. For n equals one, it's easy, right? You just pick either right or left.
It's a bandit.
It's a bandit, exactly. But then for two and whatever, two is pretty good. But the point is that if you just select policies at random or any of these dithering approaches, it will take you 2 to the n episodes to learn. So even for n equals 20, that's going to be a million, even a million episodes for picking randomly. But because the actual world is like an n by n grid, you should be able to learn it in a polynomial in n. Right, there are algorithms that can learn it more like an n squared or whatever. And it turns out that if you correctly do Thompson sampling with a reasonable prior, then yeah, you'll learn it in something that scales like that. Now, this problem is not super interesting if you just encode it with all these things in a tabular, setting. It's not super interesting. What's interesting is a thought experiment. But B Suite kind of tries to bridge this gap between the deep learning world and the theory world by turning this into like we make a version of this game with like a Tetris-like interface. And you try to solve it with deep neural networks. And now we say, okay, can I make a neural network approach that can solve this? And I'll tell you for free that even mu zero, even mu zero that solved everything, even you throw all the TPUs in the world at it, it's going to take a huge, huge, thousands and thousands of years to solve it, right? And it's just because this is how it's set up. And even if it did solve it, I could make the n one bigger and it would take twice as long again, right? It just doesn't work well, even more than twice as long in practice. But if you do some of these like Thompson sampling approaches, like I studied and PhD, then you can do it. And so basically in my PhD, maybe we made approaches, this bootstrap DQN that solved it by instead of having a neural network Q value, you've got an ensemble of Q values, all neural networks. And what we showed in some of this paper is like, hey, you can replace, we said before that the EpiNet could get as good joint predictions as an ensemble of size 100. And you're like, oh, that's kind of cool, but I don't really care about joint prediction. But yeah, I guess if you like that. And then I say, okay, now you can drop in the EpiNet for the ensemble, and it gets just as good performance on this on this exploration task. And now maybe you're more interested. You say, hey, wait, I can do as well as I did before, but it costs me 100 times less. And in that paper, we also compare with some other methods like dropout or this or that. And we also show there's kind of an empirical relationship in how well you're doing on the joint prediction and how well you do on these tasks. So that's kind of cool.
So you've developed this whole framework for uncertainty, and I hear you've brought it to the world of LLMs now as well. So can you tell us more about that? How can LLMs benefit from EpiNets or your approach to uncertainty?
Yeah, so on this, I can definitely point you to some, published work, and I've been involved in some, but I guess since I left DeepMind, a really great paper came out from some of my co-authors. I think Vikrant is the first author, Ben Muhammad. Really good work on efficient exploration in LLMs. And I think that this modern regime of like chatbots and LLMs and RLHF, reinforcement learning from human feedback, I think that that's a scenario where this idea of efficient exploration, and in this case, the exploration is, well, what do you choose to show to the either the human users or the human raters who are going to give you feedback? And the idea being that if you prioritize what you show to the rater, hey, I want to maybe show completions where I'm more uncertain, right? Or I can learn more about what the best solution is. And I guess they show very clearly and very nicely that using these styles of approaches, using these sort of ENNs for uncertainty, you can do much better. You can get much better performance using much fewer labels. And the emphasis isn't only on using fewer labels, the emphasis is on scaling better to like bigger systems and getting better performance. And this allows you to do that.
So hopefully the next ChatGPT might have your EpiNets inside.
Top secret, but yeah, of course, we're all hoping for
You heard it here first, folks.
that.
Do you feel like the framework you've developed here is really the solution that you need for epistemic uncertainty, or do you feel like there's a lot of loose ends, or do you feel like it's more just like building this out and proving it that this is the way?
Are there a lot of loose ends? Yes, there are a lot of loose ends. I do think that. Oh, do I think? I think that some of these ideas of thinking about joint prediction, thinking about information gain, I think that is really a good idea because I think this whole, we started by saying, oh, you're interested in epistemic uncertainty. I think that that's actually a bit of a quagmire because you get bogged down in, well, what's your model? Who's to say what's epistemic? Oh, I've got this model. You've got that model. What's your prior? And I think that actually looking at joint prediction is a more healthy way to do it because you're kind of focused on solutions. I definitely am bullish on some of these ideas like EpiNet and the potential for different ENN architectures for sure. I think that's a really cool thing because it opens up the ingenuity and network design and the same way that there were ConvNets and whatever, it's like, oh, I'm going to design a different kind of network architecture for uncertainty modeling, the transformer or whatever, stuff like that. I think there's a lot of potential work that could be done there. And I'd be super excited for people to blast out the EpiNet approach out of the water, and then I'll switch over. So I think it's pretty cool, a cool space to be in, to kind of focus on the solution rather than focus on the problem approach.
So you talked about some things you're looking forward to. Do you want to say more about your plans for your own future work?
Broadly speaking, it's kind of, I think my old advisor Ben has been really great in, setting an example or showing us like, if you want to work on a problem, I think it's good to work on problems that you'd be happy to work on for a long time. And so for me, this problem of like building artificial intelligence or dealing with uncertainty and how to think about what to learn, I think it's just like the biggest and most exciting problem around for me. Because, whatever, I'm not that smart. And ideally, I can make something or help make something that will help us all learn better and will solve those problems. So, in a way, it's like a meta solution to every other problem. That's why I think AI and intelligence is so exciting. But maybe what I'm excited about is making AI systems that prioritize their own learning. At the moment, it's all the kind of experts and geniuses at OpenAI, at DeepMind, coming up with different approaches. And I think if you could really have these kind of superhuman AIs, optimizing their own learning, maybe that opens up a whole new level of progress. It also helps with safety as well. I've not talked about safety or all these things, but a lot of people talk about the worries about AI safety. I also think I don't view them at that at odds with each other. I think that the idea of, one way to talk about this uncertainty and this RLHF, you could call it aligning the AI, aligning it to do what you want it to do. And I think that dealing with uncertainty and kind of a lot of these weird thought experiments of like, oh, it's going to turn the whole universe to paperclips. I think that if you add in a bit of uncertainty, like the model, hey, they said to make as many paperclips as possible, but did they really mean like as many as possible? Like maybe that was a linearization in this regime, right? I think that if you get into stuff like that, a lot of those weird thought experiments might, I think that this is the way to solve them. I don't think they go away, but I think that working on this is actually these type of capabilities will help us with safety rather than not.
So if Epinets can keep GPT-7 from turning us all into paperclips, I'm all for it. I'm all for it.
Exactly.
Okay. So besides your own work, Ian, can you talk about any other things that are happening in RL these days that you find pretty interesting?
I am so enthusiastic about the work in, RL in general. I mean, by far the thing that got me most excited probably was ChatGPT. That's really kind of why I had it was a difficult decision, left Google, left DeepMind. I think there's a feeling for some people in the field like, oh, RL had its heyday and there was a the DeepRL workshop was so exciting. Everyone did Atari and you had this I had this PPO variant and that was exciting. Oh, that. But for me, those were kind of approximate policy solutions, or it's just like optimizing to get these policies on these games. And kind of the real RL are these systems. The real problem is interacting in the world and accomplishing goals. And so it's almost like the game is finally real, and RL, the problem, has never been more relevant, right? So by that I mean, hey, we need to be able to generalize from this kind of data. We need to be able to explore and take actions in a space that's really high dimensional. Hey, we need to worry about long-term consequences because when I have a conversation, all the models that people are doing for this RLHF, they're basically bandit models, right? They try to optimize the one-step return. They want to get an answer after one. You type in something, they give you the answer one time. But if I talk with you, you try to like set up a really good conversation, and if someone's trying to teach you something, they don't just jump to the answer in one go, right? We're not doing that with our current chatbots. So for me, it's obvious that RL, the problem, has never been more relevant, has never been more exciting. I'm amazed that this is really hitting the big time. And also, these RLHF solutions are doing better than just pure supervised learning. So that's amazing. I'm not super worried. I think that worrying too much about, oh, am I doing A2C? Am I doing PPO or whatever? You might be missing the forest for the trees. So I'm super excited about, this RL AI and the next generation of AI systems.
So, Ian, while you're here, is there anything else you want to share with the audience today?
Well, thanks so much for having me on again. This has been really fun. And I'm definitely open for feedback or questions if this gets you interested, or you think, hey, Ian, you're full of shit, maybe I shouldn't have sworn there anyway. But yeah, reach out to me on Twitter or send me an email and I'll be happy to chat.
Dr. Ian Osband, this has been an absolute pleasure for me, a long time coming. Thanks so much for taking the time today.
Thanks a lot.